Filibuster, late 18th century, from French filibustier, first applied to pillaging pirates. Now a prolonged speech that brings the ordinary workings of a legislative assembly to a standstill. See, for example, the junior senator from Kentucky, who one day this past spring rose in the Senate chamber to protest administration policy and kept talking for 13 hours. With us today, Senator Rand Paul. Uncommon Knowledge, now. Welcome to Uncommon Knowledge. I'm Peter Robinson. Born in 1963, Randall Howard Paul attended Baylor, then received his medical degree from Duke. Although raised in Texas, after medical school, Dr. Paul moved to Kentucky, where his wife grew up, to begin practicing ophthalmology and become active in politics, founding Kentucky Taxpayers United. In 2010, Dr. Paul was elected to the United States Senate. The son of former Congressman Ron Paul, who ran for president once as a Libertarian and twice as a Republican, Senator Paul has in 2 years in the Senate become a national figure. As a recent issue of The Economist put it, Senator Paul, quote, is definitely not his dad. Rand Paul is trying to build a coalition that can win. Senator Paul, welcome.
Glad to be with you.
Governing philosophy. Let me quote you. Senator Rand Paul, quote, the government isn't inherently stupid. It just doesn't get the same signals. Explain that.
Well, you know, I usually say they're not inherently stupid, but it's a debatable question. And the reason it is that there's a difference between what drives the marketplace and what drives the excellence of the marketplace. And I usually say there are sort of two reasons for minimal government. One's a liberty argument, that the more you give up of your wealth and your earnings, the less liberty you have, and so you want to minimize government size. But you also want to minimize government size because of efficiency. As Friedman said, nobody spends someone else's money as wisely as they spend their own. And I think that's what that gets at the heart of as far as inherent stupidity. It's just that they're just not getting the signal that a private business person gets as far as trying to maximize a profit. And I'm actually in favor of trying to put some of that back into government to try to make government more efficient. And I would actually pay government officials on how much savings they find in their department.
So you'd suggest bonuses based on savings instead of ever increasing salaries based on the size of your department.
Exactly. And the incentive is now, when there's money left in your department, if you have a governmental department, is to spend it all so you get it next year.
Right, right. You're the third of five children,
right,
of Congressman and Mrs. Ron Paul. How did you come to your political philosophy? Was this dinner table conversation in the Paul household when you were a kid?
Well, in my case, there's probably the argument of nature versus nurture. And I may have had both. And I think we're all born with an instinct, you know, to individualism, you know, we grow up in a family, and even in my family as a teenager, I remember calculating how old I would be in the year 2000 and how I'd be completely independent and able to make my own decisions, stay up as late as I want, eat what I want, go where I want, earn my own money. So I think we all have a little bit of that inside of us, maybe some to one degree or more. But then there's also the nurture argument in the sense that, you know, I've read most of the free market economists. I am, a student of history. And what I see is that I would really like to see a government that truly is limited, you know, and that our freedom is much more expansive.
Okay, so let's spend a moment considering what's gone wrong. William Vogley wrote a book, Never Enough, on the expansion of the welfare state. And he made this very striking point, that from 1940 to 2007, welfare spending grew at an average annual rate of just over 4%, and this is while income is growing at about 2.4%. The point is that for almost seven decades, year in, year out, under presidents of both parties, under congresses of both parties, the federal welfare leviathan has continued to grow and grow and grow. Ronald Reagan held back the growth in spending, but even he wasn't able to cut it. Why? What's the political dynamic?
Well, even welfare reform affected maybe four programs out of 70 or 80 programs, so it wasn't complete enough. I put it in more personal terms, and I think this is something that can appeal to people across both parties and independents as well, is that if you look like me and you hop out of your truck, you ought to be working. And I think most people believe that. We're now registering, though, more people as disabled than we are employing people, and that's a real problem. But it's a gradual problem. Republicans and Democrats have been complicit in this, but it's growing, growing, growing. And people worry that such a great deal of dependency will ultimately drag us down as a country. And that's where the burden of debt comes in. And I think there really is a burden. But our message is a more difficult one. We need to explain to those who are working class and trying to get ahead that this burden of big government, that all of this stuff that government's offering you really has unintended consequences of dragging the economy down, dragging job creation down.
All right. In March, you introduced a budget that would have eliminated the federal deficit in 5 years. You voted against the budget the House sent over that Paul Ryan put together, because although even as you were voting against Paul Ryan's budget, the press was attacking it as too dramatic, too
draconian.
Isn't
that amazing, yeah.
Right, yeah, but that would have reduced the federal deficit over 10 years, and Rand Paul said not fast enough.
Well, I think we're dragging a lot of the party in the right direction. Ryan's first budget was going to balance in 28 years. Now he's come up to 10 years. You know, there were a little bit of unrealistic things. They were going to get rid of Obamacare spending, but he left in the Obamacare taxes. So we really think that we need a change. And I'm for a much more dramatic change than some of the gradualists in our party. I think we ought to just have a flat income tax, 17% personal, 17% corporate, very few deductions. You'd have a lot less revenue. This would not be revenue neutral, but I think you'd see an explosion in the economy as you left all of that money into the economy.
Senator, here's the first instance of a question that comes up again and again and again, listening to you, reading your speeches. What makes him think he's different? And here's the version, the instance right now. Republicans have been pushing for a flat tax since at least 1996 when Steve Forbes ran for president.
But he didn't win. If he would have won, we'd have had it by now. So we need to win.
So that's the point. What makes you think you're different? What makes you? Do you see, I'll put it crudely, because this is a question that's in the air about you. Is Rand Paul just trying to make a point?
Right.
And so be it. Let him make a point. There's nothing wrong with it. It's a valid point. Or does he see a political opportunity? Can he actually get things done?
Right. See, I don't think anybody can sit here and say, oh, I am different. I'm going to be the one. I'm the one. That's a little bit presumptuous. However, I would say that there is a route to victory for Republicans nationally without diluting our message, being for something passionately. But I think it takes a twist that's slightly different. You're from out in California. California, we say bluish. It's a blue state.
It sure is.
To bring it back red, you're going to have to attract people different than the standard cookie-cutter Republicans been. So I am offering something different. And the libertarian twist to that, I think, has appealed to both ethnic minorities as well as the youth, as well as independents. It's really a message that gets beyond our hardcore Republican. But it's not antithetical to what hardcore Republicans stand for. But it is enough of a twist that I think it has a chance to resonate in areas where we have not done very well.
All right. Immigration, that's the big bill in the Senate right now. The legislation is complicated, but very briefly, the legislation now before the Senate, voted out of committee, first proposed by the so-called Gang of Eight, including your fellow freshman Republican Marco Rubio of Florida. Immigrants already in the country illegally would be required to register with the government, pay a fine. They would then become RPIs, or registered provisional immigrants. A three-part enforcement regime would be established: E-Verify system to track visa holders, increased border security. And then when all three parts of the enforcement regime are implemented, and only after remaining in RPI status for 10 years would RPIs, again, registered provisional immigrants, only then would they be permitted to apply for green cards. And then they'd have to remain on green cards for a period of 3 years before applying for citizenship. How's that sound to you?
I'm for immigration reform. We've got a broken system. We have 10, 11 million people here who came in illegally, or they came in legally and now became undocumented. So we have to fix the system. If we do nothing, in another 10 or 15 years, we have another 10 million who come in illegally. So I am for documenting the undocumented, letting them pay taxes. If you want to work in our country, I'm for finding a place for you. That being said, there are still some problems with the bill. The bill does what most bills around here do. It delegates the authority to the administration to say, okay, you have to fix border security, but if you don't, someone has to write a report about you not fixing it. And then if the report doesn't work, then we'll have a commission that will issue another report. That stuff doesn't work, and that's why people are so distrustful of government. As a conservative, to support this, I have to believe that we're going to fix the problem. The big driver of illegal immigration is that we have a work visa program that's not working. And so right now, 300,000 or 400,000 people come in to pick crops every year, but only 65,000 of them use the work visa program. Mm-hmm. So most of them are coming in illegally. Unfortunately, the bill actually limits and adds new caps to ag visas. That's a mistake. It does expand some of these skilled workers, which is good, but it puts caps on the ag visas, which if that cap is below what the market dictates, you're still going to have illegal immigration. So we have an amendment. If I can get my amendment passed, I may be able to support the bill. And my amendment's called Trust But Verify. Conservatives want to believe that it's going to happen. So we write into the law some of the same border security in the bill. We just write it in the bill and say, do it. But then we say each year Congress gets to vote. And if it's the border's not secure and we don't think the administration is enforcing it the way it's supposed to, then the process stops. So if you have 10 million people that are going to go from undocumented to documented workers, it happens gradually over a 5 or 6 year period. And each year we vote as to whether the border's becoming more secure. I think that will convince conservatives like myself that we're serious. People are still talking about the 1986 Simpson-Mazzoli bill, and they're saying they promised us border security, and then it never came. That's why conservatives are hesitant to vote for immigration reform.
Right. So among conservatives then, you listen to talk radio, you read the conservative magazines, and that's exactly it. My own reading of the reaction against the immigration bill is less that conservatives across the country feel any animus toward immigrants at all. It's a deep feeling of betrayal by the federal government, which since 1986 has failed to enforce the law at the border.
Right.
Okay, so you said that you're in favor of documenting undocumented workers. If they're here to work, let's find a way to let them do it legally. Mark Krikorian of the Center for Immigration Studies. Registered provisional immigrant status brings with it work authorization, a legitimate social security account, driver's license, travel documents. Since it transforms the illegal alien into a person lawfully admitted to the United States, registered provisional immigrant status is an amnesty.
Well, I think if we get trapped into words and describing things just as either amnesty or pathway to citizenship, these are catchwords that mean different things to different people. What I would say is, and I've come to look at this maybe slightly different than I once did, the 11 million that are here, almost half of them came here legally. Right. They got a visa and they came here to pick crops at $8 an hour. But they were working hard to provide for their family at $8 an hour, and they saw a construction job that was $14 an hour. And it's a free market. It's open and it's there. It's like we tell them they can't do it. So our visa program, which is big government, failed the immigrant and said, you can't go take a higher paying job. Unfortunately, this bill does the same thing. It locks you into agricultural work because the unions have gotten involved. The union and the chamber negotiated caps on workers and the ability to go from job to job. So you can't go from ag worker to construction worker under this bill for at least 5 years. The problem is, if you're a normal person, you've been here 2 or 3 years and you're making $8 an hour, it's not an easy way to provide for your family. All of a sudden, a $14 an hour job opens up. Even under today's, will you still move to that and will we still have this undocumented problem?
Final question about immigration. Jeb Bush has said the GOP, the quotation is, needs to get immigration behind it. Right? You've said that it's impossible for the GOP to make any headway with Hispanics as long as the Republican Party is viewed as hostile toward immigrants. They just shut down. They won't listen to the rest of the message. Okay. But don't we know what will happen if this immigration reform is enacted? During this 10-year waiting period, Democrats will again and again and again say, shorten the waiting period. Right. Again and again, they'll say, start giving these people federal benefits. It won't put immigration behind the Republican Party.
Maybe. And there is a problem that I think...
It'll give the Democrats a chance to just make these people such solid Democratic voters. A century from now, it'll still...
There is a potential problem. And I often believe that maybe the Democrats want voters, not workers. However, I would say if we do nothing... Let's say we do nothing. We have 11 million people here. They are having children who are becoming citizens, and many have been here long enough that their kids are voting. If their kids believe, and if they believe that the Republican Party is the party of deportation, we will never get any of their votes. So I think really it's not the specifics of immigration reform. When I talk to Hispanic leaders in Kentucky and elsewhere, they tell me we want to be treated with dignity. Mm-hmm. When you call us an illegal, you're implying that we stole something, or we robbed somebody, or we hurt somebody, and really all we were trying to do was make a better way for our family. So a lot of it is Republicans need to get away from harsh rhetoric. They need to embrace immigrants as assets to our country. My family were immigrants. Yours probably were too. All of us were. And the rules were different and maybe easier to come here at one point in time. But we can't have open borders either. I mean, Milton Friedman said that as well. You can't have open borders and a welfare state.
Right.
But some of the arguments for saying, oh, these people are going to come in and overwhelm welfare is those are also arguments for fixing welfare, because those are arguments against any kind of population expansion, because any new births we have in the country will eventually, a certain percentage of them will be on welfare.
Your fundamental position is shrink the welfare state and welcome immigrants, because with a shrunken welfare state, they'll be here for the same reason immigrants have always come here. That's to get a job and better their families.
Right. And the other thing we will add to the bill is we also have a bill, an amendment that says that each individual state has to check for citizenship before voting, and they have to have a process. They can't just say, oh, are you a citizen? Check. They actually have to have a process or they're going to lose federal funding. We also have in there that if you want to get welfare, the bill says you can't get welfare.
This is your amendment.
Yes.
Right.
Our amendment says that if someone comes in and applies for welfare, you have to check to make sure they're here legally or a citizen, because the bill says, oh, we're not going to give welfare. The problem is that many states and cities just say, oh, we don't care. We're not going to put it on the form. Right. We're going to say it has to be put on the form, because a lot of the money is federal money in the welfare programs. There's federal mixed with state sometimes for voting and as far as for welfare. So we're going to try to make the bill stricter, but I want in the end to be able to vote for it. But as it is, it needs to be strengthened, because it's not going to pass in the House this way either.
What do you think, as we sit here today, early June, what are the chances you'll be able to vote for it?
If they will come and talk to me, the chances will improve greatly. So far, there hadn't been a great deal of conversation. We're going to see, but some of it depends. If I get no headway towards the things that I want amended to the bill, then I don't think I can support it.
Okay. Getting to know Rand Paul, let me just briefly go through a few other issues so people get a chance to know where you stand. Obamacare. This fall.
Against.
Okay, done with that one. But where does it stand? This fall, this thing gets rolled out in a way that finally affects, provisions here and there have been taking effect, but this fall, it'll affect the way millions of Americans purchase their health insurance. Paul Krugman of the New York Times says the big surprise will be how well it works, not how badly, how well.
This will not be the first time I've disagreed with Paul Krugman. What I would say is we've fought many different times, but I'm not giving up the fight. We fought and lost originally in Congress. We fought again in the presidential campaign and lost. We fought at the Supreme Court and lost narrowly, and I think was still wrongly decided. But we're going to have one more fight when the bills come due. Initially, the federal government's going to pay for it, because that's free. We've heard we have a printing press up here, so it really doesn't cost anything. But then ultimately, the bills are going to be directed back to state government. And what they'll find is that when you offer people a free credit card to go get health care, that they love it. And so they use it all the time, but then it costs so much, there's not enough money. So then they have to come back and they have to tell you, oh, no, you can't go unless you get, someone's going to have to screen you. They're going to have to ration how often you go to the doctor. And then they'll come to the physician and say, well, we were paying you $20 a visit, but there's too many people coming to see you, so we're going to have to pay you $10 a visit. So they will have to reduce the expenditures, what they pay hospitals, what they pay doctors, and they will also have to limit access, which is another word is rationing. And the state governments, despite all of this, will still face bankruptcy. Not just the states like your state, like California or Illinois, that are in trouble. States that are relatively sound are going to face problems, because Medicaid is already a driving force towards insolvency at the state level. So I think there's going to be one more big fight on Obamacare, but it's going to be at the state legislative level.
And when? This year?
Next as the bills come due. And I think the switching over to the state is 2014, but some of it may be 2014, 2015.
In time for the presidential in 2016?
I think so. I think it'll still be a hot topic in 2016.
Drugs, The Economist magazine. Senator Paul has called for the scrapping of mandatory minimum sentences for nonviolent drug offenders, but would not legalize drugs.
Right. What I think is that if your kid or one of his friends goes out and gets caught with marijuana, sticking them in prison's a big mistake. So I don't really believe in prison sentences for these minor nonviolent drug offenses. But I'm not willing to go all the way to saying it's a good idea either. I think people use marijuana all the time, lose IQ points. I think they lose their drive to show up for work. A lot of states are going to make the decision, I think, ultimately to legalize.
Sure, right.
I am for letting states make that decision, but I'm not in favor of, and I want to make sure people know that I'm not encouraging young kids to do this, but I also don't want to see young kids who make mistakes be put in prison with hardened prisoners. And I think I think even when you talk to evangelical Christians and social conservatives, you ask them that question, would you rather see your teenager in your church get counseling or incarceration? Almost everybody will answer counseling.
But when California loosens its laws and comes into conflict with federal laws, you side with California, not the feds.
Yes.
All right. Social issues. Senator Rand Paul, quote, I am 100% pro-life. I believe abortion is taking the life of an innocent human being, close quote. Senator, where I come from out in Northern California, when somebody says he's a libertarian, 98% of the time he's saying he's a libertarian about that.
Right.
He's pro-choice. Keep the government out of the bedroom.
Right.
And so this is an unusual position, in my experience, for a libertarian to take. How do you square that one up?
What I would say is that there is a primary and fundamental role for government. And the primary and fundamental role for government is to stop aggression of one individual against another individual. So the question comes down to, when do you think someone's an individual? When do you think life begins? And then I think you get more to the heart of the matter is, the real debate is, when does life begin? And I think as you have that discussion, it becomes difficult, I think, to be flippant about it. For example, you know, I'm an ophthalmologist, but I examine babies in the neonatal nursery that can fit in the palm of my hand, 1-pound babies that are alive. I look in their eyes to check against a disease that can cause blindness that can be treated now. But let's say a week before they were, you know, inside the mother, but are they just, they don't exist, they're not alive at that point. And so increasingly, later on in gestation, people are somewhat horrified. I mean, people are horrified by this Dr. Gosnell that was snipping the spinal cords of them. They're horrified by people, you know, crushing the skull to get the baby out, you know, a live baby, injecting things into them to kill them. So I think many people towards the end are like, well, gosh, yeah, it's not that much different than the nursery. How can I be that this is just a woman's body and that there isn't another individual there? But it's a tough debate. And I think the Republican Party, when I say that I want to be a libertarian Republican, it is also that we'll have disagreements like this within the party, and there will be people, if we leave the decisions more local to their jurisdiction, I think we can have more of a diversity of opinion within the party and within the country.
Overturn Roe versus Wade and send it back to the states?
Yeah, I think states would be a better area for this.
Gay marriage. Senator Rand Paul, quote, I believe in the historical definition of marriage. That being said, I'm not for limiting contracts between adults, close quote.
That sounds like me.
It's you. Yeah. There's a reason it sounds like you.
Yeah, and I think that it's the same issue, you know, and I think some people get confused. I stand with the founding fathers on this. You know, Jefferson, Franklin, nobody ever talks about them in marriage. Marriage was always a state issue in their day, and that's the way it was written. We didn't write a lot of things like that into the federal Constitution. In fact, not only issues like that, which don't really involve crime, but issues of crime were all state issues. They didn't really conceive of. There were about 4 different things that were federal crimes under the Constitution, and nobody really conceived of all these things. Now, anytime there's a terrible tragedy, it's got to be a federal law instead of, well, why don't you go to your state legislature, because that's maybe more appropriately where this should be handled.
All right. Well, I want to turn to foreign policy in a moment, but one more last biggish question. Let me quote to you Daniel Patrick Moynihan, 1965, his famous report entitled The Negro Family, the Case for National Action. Quoting Moynihan, the fundamental problem is that of family structure. The Negro family in the urban ghettos is crumbling. Middle class has managed to save itself, but for vast numbers of the unskilled and poorly educated, the fabric of social relationships has all but disintegrated. So long as this situation persists, the cycle of poverty and disadvantage will continue to repeat itself. Moynihan writes that in 1965, when the illegitimacy rate among African Americans was 25%. Today, among whites, the illegitimacy rate is 36%, among Hispanics, more than half, and among African Americans, more than 72%. So you can see where this is going. Block grants, lower taxes, more economic growth. What does any of it matter if the American family continues to disintegrate?
Right. Well, and now it's no longer, if it ever was, a racial problem. It's a cultural problem.
Right.
It's across all races. Charles Murray writes about this in Coming Apart, and he's looked at the different strata. And it's an amazing thing that every kid should know, and it should be taught in every school, is that there are two groups of people in our country, those who have kids when they're not married and those who don't. And if you look at the two lines, these are the ones in middle class and achieving well. The ones in poverty are those who are having kids, sometimes 5, 6 kids without being married. I can't make a law to tell you to get married or your kids to get married. So it really is the idea that really something bigger has to happen. This is what I say in the churches all the time when I speak in churches, is that don't look towards your politicians for all the answers. Look to your spiritual leaders. Look to this country needs a revival and a cultural reformation, but it's not going to come from government or a law.
So this is one thing I wanted to draw out, because again, my understanding of libertarians is pretty heavily conditioned by Northern California. And another element of libertarianism tends to be sort of agnosticism. You won't find too many libertarians showing up in church, and yet there's Senator Rand Paul. So the question is, if the breakdown of the family produces a demand for big government, it certainly produces Democratic voters. We know single mothers, kids who are upset, young adults who've been raised in broken homes, elderly people who are living in isolation because they no longer have family support. Those are folks who tend to vote Democratic.
Right.
If you care about small government, there's almost a requirement to care about supporting the family, isn't there?
Well, I think so.
And you do draw that connection explicitly.
And there are different ways to look at it, because there's one, which is a moral and religious argument for the family and for the traditions of it.
And you buy that. Libertarian though you are, you buy the moral argument.
Yeah, but there's also an argument that completely beyond religion. If you're an agnostic libertarian and you say, keep the government out of my family structure, I would also say that why don't we simply teach that there's an economic argument for this, that poverty is associated with having kids before you're married, and the family structure helps to keep you out of poverty. And it's not a perfect society. And I think the danger in saying things like this is people say, well, I had my kids before I was married, and look, I'm doing fine, or I'm not a bad person, or I'm divorced. So it really isn't directed towards the individual, but when you look at the statistics, it is an enormous cultural problem. And this is an argument, you know, it's not just say no. This is sort of an argument for birth control. It's an argument for planning your family and planning, you know, when you have it.
Foreign policy. The second inaugural address of President George W. Bush, quote, "The survival of liberty in our land increasingly depends on the success of liberty in other lands," close quote. To be safe at home, we need to promote liberty abroad. Do you buy that?
Yes, to a certain extent. I think it depends on how you want to promote liberty. And, you know, we have some people who think supporting the Syrian rebels right now is a way to promote liberty. I think it's much more murky than that. We need to have a healthier debate to determine when we get involved and when we don't get involved. You know, you could argue that the Arab Spring has brought more liberty to the Middle East, but you could also argue that democracy, they've chosen people who are much more antagonistic towards our country, and that if anything, the governments that ultimately settle in Egypt, in Libya, and maybe in Syria, depending on what happens, may or may not be more friendly towards America, and there's a very good chance we'll be less friendly. So you have to be careful what you wish for.
Okay, I'm going to try to continue to draw you out here. You gave a speech at the Heritage Foundation on foreign policy this past February. Quote, "Ronald Reagan did not shy from labeling the Soviet Union an evil empire, but he also sat down with Gorbachev and negotiated reductions in nuclear weapons." True. Of course, Reagan sat down with Mikhail Gorbachev after the biggest military buildup in our history, a 600-ship navy, arming freedom fighters in Central America and Afghanistan, and initiating the Strategic Defense Initiative. So Reagan uses rhetoric and he uses diplomacy, but boy, did he also use power, right?
Yes, but I would say if you look at him with regard to involvement, I would say that he in some ways was more restrained than presidents before or after him as far as direct military involvement. When we were in Lebanon and had the tragedy with the Marines there, he actually made the decision to come home because he said it was too murky and they couldn't figure out and it wasn't a safe way to have him in there. It gets, you know, goes forward to like Benghazi now. Was it safe to have an embassy there? Was it safe to have an embassy under State Department control? Was it safe to stay there when all your military support was saying we need more security and it was denied? So I think that Reagan really exemplified peace through strength, but I think some of the neoconservatives up here interpret that as war through strength, that war is always the option, that we always have to be involved. But consequently, they get caught up in a lot of contradictions. So, for example, many of the people who wanted to arm the Libyan rebels also wanted to arm Gaddafi the year before. Now many of them want to arm the Syrian rebels who are allied with al-Qaeda against Assad, who is also allied with the Christians. So it's really a murky situation you have in Syria, and I'm not sure it's a good idea.
So your heroes as chief executives would be Ronald Reagan, who uses a great deal of force but rhetoric and diplomacy and is very careful about actually using force, or maybe Dwight Eisenhower, who ends the war in Korea 6 weeks into his presidency, and then throughout the rest of his presidency, there's only one direct engagement in Lebanon.
I think Eisenhower's been underappreciated.
Yeah,
you know,
I do too,
and
actually.
One of his quotes that I love is that he says, "I hate war like only a soldier who's lived it can."
Right.
The stupidity, the banality, the futility.
So, Iraq, was it a mistake to go in the first place?
Yes.
It was in the first place. Okay.
Not with Afghanistan. I was supportive of going into Afghanistan, but even Afghanistan now, the mission's been lost, and you know, we've gotten bin Laden, we've disrupted the Taliban, and after 10 years, if we haven't trained the Afghan army, we're not going to. But I would say there's a good analogy in Afghanistan as to why Syria is such a mistake. After 10 years of being in Afghanistan, it's a fairly stable, you know, it's like we can pick people to be in the military on the Afghan side and we train them. We still can't figure out friend from foe. Many people join the Afghan army and they just lie. They say, "Oh, yes, we were supportive of Americans." And when the American soldier turns, they shoot him in the back. That's happened 100 times. Imagine how much more difficult it's going to be in Syria when you're handing out Stinger missiles and man pads and all of the sophisticated weapons to decide who's friend and who's foe.
Okay, so let me ask about Pakistan, say. We've got the drone program going on. They're killing bad guys. There's collateral damage, horrible phrase for meaning deaths to civilians.
Right.
That requires, as I understand it, that requires a presence on the ground to develop our own intelligence separate from what the Pakistanis tell us. And the notion would be that that's pretty directly related to the defense of this republic. We're not trying to engage in nation building in Pakistan. So you'd support the drone program?
I think that within and throughout the world, on-the-ground intelligence is something that we do have to spend money on and that we do need to be concerned with. And that means Arabic speakers in our military as well as our State Department and people living in those countries and knowing about it. Pakistan's probably one of the most worrisome places in the world. There's a significant amount of hatred for America there. But I don't see giving $2 billion a year directly to the Pakistan government. They're imprisoning really the best informant we ever had, maybe, or one of the betters, Shaquille Afridi, who helped us get information on bin Laden. We're not going to get much more information from informants if we don't protect our informants. And I think it's been a mistake that we continue to give money to Pakistan despite them imprisoning him for the rest of his life. With regard to the drone program, there's definitely a usefulness for drones within combat and within the military. Anything that can save our soldiers' lives, I'm for. Killing non-combatants, American citizens, I think they should be tried for treason. It's a very rare occurrence. We've only targeted one, and I think he should have just been tried for treason. Then maybe you target him, but really there should have been a court. I don't like a politician deciding guilt of an American. You know, next time you're in France, I don't like them just deciding to, you know, waylay you with a drone as opposed to having some kind of court decide that you're a traitor. With regard to foreigners, I think there is a time, you know, bin Laden, I think, deserved what he got, and he should have, whether it was with a drone or with individual soldiers. And so there are some leaders of these terrorists that I think should be killed. But once you've knocked off the top leadership, and then you knock off the next leadership, and the next leadership, is there ever an end? And is there a point in time at which it becomes sort of a recruiting tool and a negative thing for America? And I think there is a point in time. There's also a point in time when you antagonize the host country to a degree that they're no longer interested in. And I think that's where we are with Pakistan. The war's gone on too long. Right? People are ready for that war to be over, and so am I. It doesn't mean that we withdraw from the world, but it does mean that the time has come for the war to end in Afghanistan.
Two last questions on foreign policy. Once again, let me quote President George W. Bush. He's speaking in May 2008. Israel's population may be just over 7 million, but when you confront terror and evil, Israel's population is 307 million because America stands with you, close quote. Is that an overconstruction? Should he make it clear that we're two sovereign nations and our interests don't always coincide, that except in very rare circumstances, we expect Israel to look to its own defense itself?
Right. Well, I think it is accepted in border skirmishes and this and that, that Israel will act in their own self-defense and that doesn't always involve the U.S. But I think it also is a useful thing to be known that we are an ally of Israel and that an attack on Israel will be something that we will respond to.
And the last question, in your March budget, you brought down military spending, but not A lot, actually. You called for a military budget, as I recall, of about $580 billion. In other words,
we actually got rid of the sequester in our budget and allowed the military budget to grow above what the sequester level were by cutting significantly other programs.
So it would be a misunderstanding of Rand Paul to say, oh, he just wants to bring everybody home. You actually call for a Pentagon, a defense establishment that remains more powerful and better funded than the next X number of countries put together, correct?
Right. There's 14 countries combined. The next 14 countries combined equal our budget. Now, I'm not saying there's not room for savings within our budget. I am for auditing the Pentagon. I am for cutting costs in the Pentagon. But what I would say is that if you're willing to cut in other parts of the budget significantly, that defense is one of our priorities. Defense is what the federal government should be doing. It is constitutional. And I'm willing to do that and willing to make it a priority. But I'm not willing to say, oh, let's throw out the sequester just to feed the military-industrial complex. I'm saying you have to keep the sequester if you're not willing to cut significantly in other places.
Last set of questions here, the Senate of the United States. Rand Paul of Kentucky, Ted Cruz of Texas, Marco Rubio of Florida, Mike Lee of Utah, the list could go on, all freshmen, all conservative, all insisting on making themselves heard now and not waiting around for a few terms until the seniority system begins to work in their favor. Congressional scholar Thomas Mann of the Brookings Institution, quote, "These are all highly visible, intelligent, articulate people who have a disdain for the institution of which they are a part and don't accept the conventional notion of what that body should be," close quote.
Well, I like the intelligent and articulate part.
He left out good looking.
Yeah. But I would, and athletic.
Right,
but
right.
I would say that I would differ with the description that we have disdain for the body. I have nothing but the greatest respect for, you know, the body of the Senate, the House, the rules, the Constitution. We've simply chosen to use the rules to try to protect the American people from overzealous and big government.
I'm getting signals that your time is out. So, in recent months, you've been in New Hampshire, you've been in Iowa, you just got back from a trip out to California. When do you intend to decide whether you're going to be a candidate in 2016? Right now would be nice, by the way. Make a little news.
You know, it must just be a coincidence. I don't know why those states keep popping up on my schedule. But no, whether I do or don't, I do want to be part of the Republican Party becoming a national party again. I think we've become a regional party, and we're seriously in danger of becoming a red state party. But we have states we need to compete in. We need to compete in New England again. We're losing our grip even in New Hampshire up there. We need to compete on the West Coast. And I truly think we can, particularly if we have a message, and it does need to be a less aggressive foreign policy. It does need to be a message that allows people in the party who culturally disagree on some of the cultural issues. And it also needs to be a message that says to the youth, we're going to stand on principle for the Bill of Rights. We're going to stand against indefinite detention, against a drone program that would strike Americans without any due process.
I said that would be the last question. I lied. This is the last question. John McCain, referring to your filibuster, your colleague, Senator John McCain of Arizona, it always seems to be the wacko birds that get the media megaphone. Did that filibuster do anything good? Did it accomplish anything within the Senate?
Absolutely. Not only just within the Senate, within the country. It's shown that really that when you stand passionately on principle for something as sacred as the right to trial by jury, that it attracts people from across the spectrum. And, you know, we've had people from the left, the right, the middle, a huge outpouring. I think we had a million retweets that day. So it was just an incredible thing. And it really is a burgeoning movement that I think becomes a movement that can win nationally again for the Republican Party.
Senator Rand Paul, junior senator from Kentucky, thank you very much.
Thank you.
For the Hoover Institution and the Wall Street Journal, I'm Peter Robinson.